Okay. Hi, everybody. All right, we're about to get started. Welcome to our wonderful author, Craig Maad. Very, very excited to have him here on the week of the publication of his new book, Things Become Other Things, which we're going to talk a little bit about. But I just want to introduce Craig briefly. There's a saying I love that books make friends, and that is certainly true for Craig and I. We've known each other for like 23 years. We met through his first book, Kohaku, which was published in 2002 and was admired by my former boss, Bill Drentel, because it had the same printer that we were using. Then we finally met in person in 2005, and we were jurors for the Art Directors Club Awards. And that led to a whole bunch of things that we've done over the years, like writer retreat with our friend Frank Shimero. We also organized a conference in Tokyo together. And after that, we got to do a walk and talk that involved a lot of the places that he writes about in this book. So it was a fun to not just read about them, but also get to experience them. Craig is a music fan, a design and product guru, a community builder, and many more things, but above all, I think a storyteller. If you dive into his newsletters, Rodin and Ridgeline, you're liable to find book reviews, camera recommendations, all kinds of meditations on the future of publishing, and dispatches from his incredible long walks in Japan. And he's got some great Notion connections too, including the wonderful Raphael Shad, who would be here if he was not on paternity leave with his new baby, but they're old friends as well. So over the last month, I've been really delighted to be able to dive into this new book, which we have some copies of here. Definitely let Brittany know if you would like one. But now we're going to chat a little bit about it. Welcome, Craig.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I think maybe just to start, and for those who aren't as familiar with the book, wanted to orient, this book brings a lot of different styles of book together. There's like a view book, there's a guidebook, there's a guidebook aspect to it. It's like also a book of letters, sort of letters to your friend Brian, letters from John to you, who's sort of a mentor of yours and someone who's guiding you on your walks. There's kind of a quest aspect to it. There's a journalistic aspect to it. It's a memoir. So it's like many, many things together. And it also has this really wonderful experimental quality. It's very like dreamlike in parts and associative. So could you talk a little bit about kind of how it developed and how it came together and a little bit like also what the editing process was like?
Yeah, so probably the easiest way to explain a lot of what I do is I do these giant walks across Japan, through Japan. And I've been doing those for about 10, 11 years now. I've lived in Japan since 2000, and I've had a couple of little 1 year, 2 year stints outside, but for the most part, I've been in Japan since 2000. So this is my 25th anniversary this year, which is pretty bizarre. So I've spent more than half my life in Japan. And about 12 years ago, I started doing these walks, and so I've walked Tokyo to Kyoto 3 times, and that takes about, if you do it slowly, it's a month. Last year, right about, actually at this moment, I was in the middle of the walk. I did it at the rate that they did it in the 1700s, I wanted to see what that felt like. And so they were doing 40K a day. So I did it in 16 days. That was not fun. It was pretty painful, 40K a day. I was carrying 3 cameras and I'm interviewing people. And as I'm doing these walks, I'm talking to everyone I see along the way. I have a whole set of rules we can talk about later, maybe if you want.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm just collecting stories, essentially looking for archetypes of ways of living. That's sort of what I've realized is kind of the main goal of what I'm collecting, like how to, what are the different shapes of life that you can have and what are the good lives that you can live out in the world and, seeing all the different shapes of that. And then putting that together. In a lot of the walks, I'd run what are called pop-up newsletters. So it's a newsletter that starts and ends with the walk. You opt into it. And then every night I send you a newsletter about the day. And so I'll do 8 hours of walking and then I'll do 3, 4, 5 hours of writing and photo editing every night and send that out. And by the end of the walk, I'll have 30, 40, 50,000 words, which is essentially like a book. So this book started 4 years ago, pretty much on today, May 10th, 2021 is when I started that walk. And I did that walk for about 30 days, sent out a bunch of newsletters. And then I thought, I'm gonna edit the newsletters into a book in 3 weeks. That was kind of my plan. And then it ended up taking 4 years. But that was sort of the broad strokes of it to turn this into a book.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, I was the recipient of many of those newsletters, and it's really fun to be able to follow you on your journey, but it's also really interesting to see how this book sort of evolved from newsletters to your readers, to your newsletter subscribers, into really like a set of letters to your friend Brian, who is someone who was part of your childhood, and, kind of helps you compare the experience you're having on the walk a little bit to the experience of growing up. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about about him and about that kind of process of comparison.
Yeah, so when you're doing the pop-up newsletters, you're writing in real time, and the deadline I find to be really generative and important. So, you know, when I'm doing the walks, after eight hours, 20, 30, 40K of walking, you're really tired. Last thing you want to do is 3 or 4 hours of writing. But it turns out you can do it. And not only can you do it, but being in that kind of slightly exhausted physical state, and then really, you know, creating this covenant or whatever, this promise to yourself that you're going to do this other work, and then doing it, you get to go to really interesting, weird, creative places. But at the same time, you're kind of holding back a little because it is essentially first drafts, real time. So when I was on the walk 4 years ago, I wasn't writing about Brian, but I was thinking about Brian a lot. And Brian was basically a kid I grew up with. And we met in first grade, we're best friends in elementary school, that sort of thing. And I'm adopted, I'm an only child, so this idea of having a brother, it's pretty powerful. And so he was essentially my brother. He had two older sisters, but the town we grew up in was kind of, at that point, you know, early 80s, entering post-industrial, Reaganomics kind of gutting a lot of stuff in America. My town was an airplane engine factory town. Across the river was the Colt factory for putting together guns. And there was like a Coca-Cola bottling factory. So it was a very blue collar, you know, kind of salt of the earthy town. And, you know, people were, you know, struggling. You know, there was sort of difficulty with jobs. There was a lot of violence. There was gang stuff happening. There was this kind of ambient sense of violence throughout our childhood. And Brian and I were best friends kind of all through elementary school. And then we sort of tested differently. I tested a little better. And that put me on a different path inside whatever the system of that, of our town. And we graduated high school, and basically a week, sort of spoiler, but you kind of get a sense of it early on in the book. A week after we graduated, he was murdered with another kid. This was not a huge surprise in my town. So the last, you know, that was almost 30 years ago. And the last 25 years I'd spent carrying a kind of a weird guilt. Could I have helped him? Could I have like averted this? Because we were side by side all through elementary school, and then getting split. And you just realize how little control you have over how the system kind of pushes you. And it was after doing the pop-up newsletter and then revisiting the pop-up and rewriting it and going back through thinking about what the book could be that Brian started to pop up. Because as I'm walking this peninsula, I'm kind of walking this area south of Kyoto, and it's also industrial, very blue-collar, socioeconomically really aligned with where I came from. And yet, the violence isn't there. There's a systemic support. You feel, obviously, healthcare, all these like fundamental social safety net things are in place, so people don't fall as far. You can't fall as far. And as I'm walking and I'm seeing little kids kind of run around, you just think, well, what would it have been like if we grew up here? It's kind of, you know, inevitable. And that kind of just more and more got pulled out of me. And then it felt like maybe finally, this is all happening during the height of COVID. So there's kind of a silence to the world and kind of a solitude. And it just felt like maybe this is the time to revisit that thing with Brian, that friendship, and think about it in the context of, you know, how my life has gone over the last 25 years since he was murdered.
Yeah, and I mean, really, you start with sort of catching him up on kind of the last few years of your life and kind of how you've integrated into Japan, how you've really become adopted Japan in a sense, and Japan has sort of adopted you. And I think the kind of the warmth and the kindliness of people that you meet there. A lot of your encounters throughout the book are with strangers in cafes, strangers on the road. I think you have a rule of like that you need to meet someone before 10 a.m. or photograph someone before. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of like the structure of your day?
Yeah, so the rules of the walks are essentially no teleporting. So no news, no social media, no podcasts, no music. The goal is to be just there in the walk and also really bored. It makes you really, really bored. Like, you know, we forget what boredom feels like. You know, every literally like half a second of free time we have, we reach for the phone, we start sort of pulling, you know, look, pull the refresh, try to get more dopamine, all this stuff. And when you take that away, it's kind of radical how much of a void, you know, is left in your brain getting rid of the smartphone. And so part of that is just what fills that void. And for me, writing fills that void. Like as I'm walking, I'm just writing. I can't stop. My brain's just already writing sentences, writing paragraphs. You know, what are we gonna, so I'm dictating a lot into AirPods, and you can kind of use a shortcuts script to like append to a note, so you don't have to touch the phone. So you can kind of be like,
I use this too. It's actually fantastic.
It's pretty cool, and the transcription's okay. But it works well enough. So I'm transcribing as I walk, and then I'm meeting people, and then snippets of conversation come in, and I'm trying to really grab all of this, especially because a lot of people I'm meeting are elderly. A lot of these areas are depopulating. Japan has, the birth rate right now is 1.2, I think. You know, it's one of the lowest in the world. South Korea's 0.7. Gideon Lewis Krause just wrote a big piece for The New Yorker about the lack of children in South Korea. It's pretty amazing. It's kind of scary. We're all sort of trending in that direction. And so a lot of the Japanese countryside is depopulating. There aren't that many kids. And then you talk to the elderly people who are running these shops, and you realize that in 10 years, almost everything I'm walking through will be gone. So these old kisaten, these old cafes, these old tatami makers, a lot of the villages, it's in 10, 15 years gone. So there is this kind of anthropological component of like, we have to grab this as quickly as possible. And I'm trying to photograph and get these conversations. And you know, there is, for me, in the book, I kind of translate and transcribe this countryside vernacular of Japanese to North Carolinian English. That's sort of in my mind. What it's almost like Appalachian English. And so that's kind of a part of how I'm transcribing in the book as well.
Yeah, all the voices are so incredible, the voices of some of the people you meet. And, I also think it's interesting the role that the landscape plays in the book as well. You know, as you're walking through the landscape, you're capturing these incredible encounters, like almost like August Sander or W.G. Sebald. Like you're kind of finding these people and using them to remember experiences in your own life or kind of capture them as reactions. But the landscape is also incredible. There's a kind of opening section about a typhoon that then you learn more about later in the book. And I think the way I interpreted it anyway was like it's sort of this thing that tosses all these pieces up into the air, and then kind of they land in a different configuration. And that's sort of a little bit the fragments of the book and the fragments of the memories and the way they come back together and the connections that you make back with them. But I also think there's COVID going on in a lot of the book, and you as a foreigner and kind of wearing a mask or trying to, you know, adhere to protocols that are maybe different from the ones you were thinking of or expecting. So maybe just talk a little bit about like the role of the environment in the book too, because I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was height of COVID, and yet Japan still only had a couple hundred cases. I mean, it was like, you know, in this area, I was walking in Mie Prefecture, in Wakayama Prefecture, were, you know, 6 cases, something like that. But everyone was being very, very careful. And I was, you know, testing and being very careful as well. And, but a lot of the shops would have signs on them saying, we don't accept out of prefecture customers. And so I'd been walking for several weeks, and I'm like, when do I become a in-group person? You know, and I would kind of open the door and be like, is it okay if I could? And no one really cared. But it was more about truck drivers. The peninsula has a lot of truck drivers coming through. And I think they just didn't want these sort of transient work-related people who might be going to bars or something at night, then coming to these little cafes for lunch and transmitting COVID. That's what they were mainly worried about. But to get back to the earlier point about not having social media, not being online, not looking at the news, creating that void, you know, allows me to, I think, connect with these people in a way that I wouldn't otherwise, because you are so bored and you're so desperate to kind of connect to someone or something. So you're more, I'm more primed to talk to people I wouldn't talk to normally. It's real easy when you have your phone to kind of just go into a place, hide in the corner, and just be in your phone. But when you don't have that and you're just sitting there, naturally people start talking to you. Or you know, I find myself so desperate for stimulation that I want to know the story more, you know. And it's this weird catalyst. I mean, it really does get me to be more social, to be more extroverted, just by having that off, in a way. And then you get to the end at the end of the day, and you've collected out of this day where you've planned nothing. You know, the only thing I plan for my walks is where I start and where I end, and I do this all before I leave because I don't want to think about this on the road. I just want to be fully present and just focused on the photography and the storytelling. I don't want to think about, where am I going to eat? Where am I going to stay? None of that stuff. And you get to the end at the end of the day, and you realize you just have this wealth of experience that you couldn't have planned for, you didn't expect. And then you can write 2, 3, 4, 5,000 words, and you get into bed, and you feel like the cards that you were dealt in the morning, you couldn't have played a fuller hand. That's the experience I started feeling. That's kind of what got me addicted to doing this, you know, more and more long walks. And you do that day after day after day, and you have this kind of physical rigor and then this creative rigor at night, and you just wring so much out of a single day. And that becomes an archetype for what's possible. And you can carry that back to your normal day-to-day life. And, you know, when I'm back at home, I don't talk to that many people. And yet I think, you know, I'll be kind of walking around Tokyo and I'll be like, it's kind of crazy. All these folks I could be stopping, I could be, you know, having a conversation with. I'm like, why don't I feel like that same sort of impetus or catalyst on my day-to-day, you know, life? And I think we do kind of close ourselves off. And I think being overly connected online, touching the phone too much, closes us off as well. And so having that, knowing I've now had hundreds of days where I've just had this total fullness, and being able to tap into that when I need to, it feels a little bit like a superpower.
And I mean, one of the genres I didn't mention is like, you know, reporting or reportage. And obviously that collection of stories, that hunger for stories, even stories of everyday life, is something that really drives you, I know. But also you've done some really interesting reportage outside of kind of this book. I mean, you've written about pizza in Japan, you've written about tourism in Japan for the New York Times. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about kind of how those experiments and writings also figure into this type of text?
Yeah, I started doing...
Or your practice, maybe more generally.
Yeah. I started doing these long linear walks. So it would be, you know, no trains, no bikes, no car, nothing. Just what you have to walk the whole time. And I thought, okay, well, this is interesting, but like, does it always have to be linear? And I started thinking about all these kind of flyover towns, like towns that you would take the Shinkansen to go to Kyoto and you'd stop at three or four stations along the way, but you'd never get off. And I just started thinking, well, what if I went to these weird little mid-sized cities that no one really goes to? And so I set up a walk through 10 mid-sized cities where I'd spend 3 nights, 4 days in each city, and I'd have to walk 50K in each city. And the idea being like, if you force yourself to walk 50 kilometers in like a mid-sized city, you're gonna touch most of it. You know, and you're going to meet a lot of people that you would meet, and you're going to go down, you're going to be looking for little roads and alleys. And I did that, and I went to Hakodate and Hokkaido, Morioka, Sakata, Matsumoto, Tsuruga, Onomichi, Matsuyama, Karatsu, Yamaguchi, and Kagoshima. And in doing that, there are a couple cities where I was like, why? This city's amazing. Why has no one ever in 23 years, this is a few years ago now, why has no one in 23 years ever told me to come to the city or told me about the city? And so one of the cities was Morioka. And the New York Times, I've been writing little pieces for them kind of freelance. And 3 years ago, they came to me and they said, hey, we're doing our 52 places to visit. They do these lists every year. We just had the 20th anniversary today, this year. And they said, hey, do you want to submit something? And I thought, yeah, you know, like I've been to these 10 cities, you know, the city Morioka was pretty cool, great independent shops, cafes, music stores, you know, music clubs, jazz clubs, just this incredible richness and some like, I don't want to make it sound overly simplified, but there's just a richness and simplicity of life.
Like an essential quality, I think.
There's an essential quality. There you go. Rob's very good with words. Essential quality.
That's what I got from your writing.
But there's an essential quality of life. And so I pitched it pretty hard to the Times. And you know, you just write this 200-word little pitch, and they don't tell you if it's going to be in the list or not. They don't tell you where it's going to be. And then the list comes out, and number one of that year was London. And then number two was Morioka. And Japan just freaked out. Like, they were just like, what? Number one? It'd be like...
You were like a lo-fi celebrity in Japan before that, but I think that was when things changed.
I was not on the radar of Japanese people. You know, all of my writing has been in English, and most of the stuff I've done has been in English. And that came out, it would be like Hoboken. It'd be like saying, like, Barcelona is the number one place to go to this year, and then number two is Hoboken. Or like, number two is, you know, a random city in Alabama. You know, it's just very, very bizarre. And they found out that I could speak Japanese, and then suddenly it was this avalanche of media. I mean, people just coming to my house, coming to hotel rooms. It was bananas. And it kind of culminated last year in the most famous TV personality in Japan, this guy Tamori-san, who wears sunglasses. His team reached out, and they wanted to do a TV show. And, you know, it was, I didn't know who this guy was. I don't have TV. You know, and before that, the mayor, you know, the article came out, and you know, the mayor reached out, and I was like, okay, I'll go meet the mayor. And I go up to meet the mayor, and I think this is going to be a very casual meeting in a back room with the mayor. And they lead me to the mayor's office, and then they go, okay, Moto-san, you know, here you go. They open the doors, and they had invited like every TV station in the country. It was just a wall of cameras. rapid fire paparazzi, you know, like DSLRs, you know, it just flashes going. It was so bizarre. I go in, I meet the mayor, I shake his hand, he goes, thank you for recommending us. And then he goes, good luck, and he leaves. And I hadn't prepared anything. I hadn't prepared a speech. And I'm in front of all of these journalists. And they open, I kind of make up the speech on the spot. I'm like, you know, thank you. I'm honored that you guys are happy about this. I hope it doesn't cause too many problems. I'm thinking of, you know, over tourism issues. I'm actually quite nervous. And, you know, I feel vulnerable in the sense that I put these people on the map. And the reason I agreed to do a lot of the media was because I wanted to help them understand why I feel like there's a good quality about their city, which can be hard to see for yourself, but also to get the most value out of this as possible, for them to really bring the most value out of this. And it's opened up to questions. And the first question is, a guy comes up, he goes, you know, Moldo-san, thank you for recommending us. How do we solve poverty? You know, and I was like, you've got the wrong guy. I just think you have awesome cafes. I like your coffee. I don't know how to solve poverty. I'm just some ding dong who walks and I pointed at your city. That's all I've done. So it was a very ego, try to be egoless as possible. And this Tamori thing, this celebrity guy who reached out and wanted to do a walk with me in the city. I didn't really want to do this. It was kind of a pain, but one of the guys in the city reached out to me and said, hey, he won't do it unless you come. And it would mean a lot to us. And so I went up there to do this thing, to do this TV show, this two-day shoot. You know, we got this crew of 40 people. There's like six cameras on us.
It was like the opposite of your normal walk situation. You've got like a roving camera crew.
It was bananas, you know. And he's kept in like a vault in a van. He's 80 years old. He's literally been on TV every day for the last 50 years. He's like, there's not one person in Japan who doesn't know this guy. He wears sunglasses. He lost vision in one of his eyes when he was a kid. And so he always has sunglasses on. He's this comedian, but he's also, you know, versed in history. He's considered a really intelligent comedian. And, you know, and they're like, you stand here. And then there's another announcer who's kind of helping us. You stand there. And then they're like, all right, call out Tamori. And he comes out of this van. You know, he's like 4 feet tall. He's this really tiny guy. And he stands next to me. And there's no introduction at all. And the camera guy goes, all right, action. I mean, it was like lost in translation. And I was just like, what the fuck? What am we going to do? You know, and Tamori goes, I'm Tamori. And then the woman next to him goes, I'm Mori-san. And I just go, ah, and I grab Tamori and I start shaking him. And I'm just like, dude, we got to say hello before we start this. I don't know what I'm doing. And like the camera crew just looked mortified. Three guys killed themselves. You know, like it was, I don't think anyone's touched Tamori-san in 50 years of him doing TV. And it went fine after that, but it was, you know, it was so stressful.
You broke the ice.
I broke the ice. And then walking through town with him was insane. I've never felt celebrity at this scale before. It was like beams of love coming off every single person. People were, you know, construction workers were screaming down, Tamori-san, you know, everyone's like, old ladies were hopping up and down. We went to the morning market. There were a few hundred people in the morning market. It was like Moses parting the Red Sea. It was just unreal, you know, 80-year-old women crying, oh my God, it's Tamori. And then people coming up to me going, thank you, Moto-san, for bringing him to town. You know, it was goosebumps walking next to this guy and just feeling that bizarre adulation, you know, but in feeling how much it meant to the city to have him there. And so it was cool to be able to do that. And then I could slink away and just disappear, you know.
I guess maybe, I think that's a good moment to sort of, this older man to kind of talk about models or mentors or kind of figures in the book. One of those is John, who kind of helps get you started with walking in Japan. You know, maybe different, but Kevin Kelly is someone that you've walked in groups with, and I know that's a different format and maybe something that would be great for you to talk about too, because I think not everybody wants to walk alone, although some people may, but maybe just to talk about those two figures and maybe contrast the two, the solitary versus the group setting.
Yeah, I mean, the me walking alone is weird. It's definitely weird to go for a 40-day walk alone. Like, it's weird. And, you know, I see it now as a response to the violence of the town. So, you know, I think what happened to my friend Brian getting murdered and me feeling like I had to move across the country and kind of create...
To be safe. Yeah.
To be safe. Because the first thing I felt when I got to Tokyo was how taken care of everyone was. And I think that, not consciously, but sort of almost ambiently, subconsciously, I felt, oh, this is a place where people are taken care of. And that was shocking to me. And that's part of what kept me there, you know, throughout my 20s. And these walks, these solo walks too, I think are also a response to all of that and trying to process it and find a way to transmute it into something interesting and find meaning. Why am I living there? Why is this, you know, why have I created a home in this place and all that stuff? But I've also done these walks with other people, and Kevin Kelly, co-founder of Wired, written a bunch of interesting books, kind of a techno-optimist, and I met 15 years ago, actually in New York, at an event, O'Reilly Media event. And we started doing walks together, and then we had so much fun doing walks together, we started doing these things called walk and talks. So we'll invite six or seven other people, and we've done 8 or 9 of them now in Bali, Thailand. We just walked in Spain 2 months ago, Cotswolds, England, and we walk for about 20K a day. We'll do this for 6 days, and then we have 7 dinners. And every dinner is a Jeffersonian dinner where you sit around the same table, it's one conversation, one topic, and we talk for about 3 hours. And kind of everyone participates in, you know, one conversation. And these walks have kind of become some of the most profound weeks of my life, being able to spend time with these incredible archetypes of people, and Kevin himself being an amazing archetype as a father, as a creator, as someone who kind of knows enough. I think there's an issue in Silicon Valley that you can see where people don't know where their lines are of enough. What, you know, when am I full? And you see a lot of folks go off the rails, especially as they become richer and richer. And then Kevin is one of these people who had the opportunity to become far richer than he is. And he's doing fine, but far, far richer than he is, because he knew where all these enough lines were, and he knew what to focus on, what was sort of fulfilling for him. And so to feel that from this guy, he's 73 now, and to be able to spend all this time together and then invite these people we love, artists, writers, photographers, actors. We had a really interesting actor, neuroscientists, you know, these really, really incredible people, to spend a week with them, and you spend all day talking. It's like adult boot camp in a weird way. And you come away, you know, people are crying, it's very emotional. But to have those kinds of weeks as these, the polar opposite of my solo walks. And there's a richness to my solo walks where I can meet people in a way that I can't when I have even one other person with me. And I can think and I can photograph. I can only photograph when I'm alone. I can't, if we're in a group, photograph. I can't get into that mind space. And so it's good to have these. You know, it feels like a good balance. And John, who's in the book, features in the book quite prominently, John is an Australian guy who got a scholarship to study in Japan when he was 16, 17. He went to Japanese university, did everything fully in Japanese, wrote his, you know, Sotsugyo Ronbun, graduation thesis, you know, by hand in Japanese, has been studying tea ceremony for 40 years. He was the CEO of Sky TV. This thing, found it with Rupert Murdoch in the early 90s. You know, anyway, this total, you know, wunderkind impresario, amazing guy. But he was walking when he was 17, 18, 19, a lot of these old roads that I'm walking now, and he started walking them again in his 50s, and he started inviting me. He's kind of connected with the art world. He did a lot for getting Aboriginal art to display around the world. I remember 20 years ago, there was a couple of big exhibitions that kind of tried, and he kind of catalyzed a lot of that. And so he was involved with art. I was involved with art in Tokyo. We kind of connected through that. And then we had this sort of shared love of walking and this history. And John really showed me how to do these walks in a way that there's a richness there. And I describe in the book how he showed me, but a richness there that I would have never been able to imagine on my own.
Yeah, there's these old pilgrimage routes, really, that he kind of walked himself and then reintroduces you to. And you even have a GPS connection at certain points, right? He can track you. And kind of send you little notes. You call it the Book of John, but it's wonderful to kind of have that kind of dialogue that's maybe not interrupting your own thought process throughout the day, but is something there for you to kind of come back to and re-anchor to. But I actually wanted to go back to Kevin for a minute, because one of the other things I think about in terms of Kevin is this idea of the 1,000 true fans, which I think is an idea that we've talked a bit about in our friendship. But you have launched this thing called Special Projects that really kind of in between all of these different publishing ventures and things like that really supports your practice. And I think it's so unique. I guess I would love for you to talk a little bit about it too.
Is anyone here a Special Projects member? Awesome, great. I get this opportunity to convert all of you. You can join today. Lifetime membership, 1,500.
But it's just a different way of interacting with your readership or something like that.
Yeah, so I started my membership program and you know, it funds everything. It funds my entire life. It is the financial basis for me to do everything that I'm doing. And it also gives me a kind of permission to do these big walks, which I started it because I've been writing these big magazine pieces, and I wanted to write about walking in Japan, and I'd been doing this huge, working on this big piece for The Atlantic for months and months and months, and then I got ghosted, and it was really painful. It just sucked. And there's this moment of, okay, well, what do I do? Why is this happening? Do I know how to write in a certain way? And I talked to a bunch of my journalist friends who were all saying, like, look, you have an audience already. You know what you want to write about. You're kind of in this perfect position to launch kind of some kind of membership thing. And so that was the catalyst. It wasn't because I wanted to do a membership program. It was because I was rejected by traditional forms of publishing. And this book too is kind of a weird milestone for me to have Random House publish something of mine. I mean, I've been doing indie fine art limited edition books my whole life. And so this is quite bizarre to have a big five publisher publish it. But it was really, starting Special Projects was just, how do I give myself the permission and how do I create a financial basis for me to do this kind of work? And it took a while. It took about 18 months before it really became something. And 18 months into it, COVID hit, and I put together this book called Kisa by Kisa. And I thought, okay, I'll make 1,000 copies. It's $100 a copy. It was about a walk from Tokyo to Kyoto, and I was eating pizza toast the whole way. And it was about these Japanese, old-style Japanese cafes. And I thought, okay, $100, you know, I've done enough books in my life where I know $100 book, 1,000 copies, it'll take 2 or 3 years to sell them all, and that'll be great. And I thought, okay, well, I also want to offer my members a discount. And I'd done Kickstarters in the past. I did a Kickstarter for Art Space Tokyo 15 or 16 years ago. It was one of the first book Kickstarters, actually. And that went really well. I did another one in 2016. That went really well. And then I looked at Kickstarter again in 2020, and I was like, this platform hasn't been updated in a decade. And I'm like, they take such a big cut. I can't even offer a discount. I can't even offer a coupon to people. And I was like, this is kind of lame. And so I started looking at Shopify. I never used Shopify before, and I'm really kicking myself because as soon as I started using it, I saw how amazing it was. I bought a bunch of Shopify stock, and I like really wish I'd done that 10 years ago, not 5 years ago. And I was like, Shopify is incredible. This template system is amazing. I wonder if I could clone Kickstarter in Shopify. And so I built Craigstarter, and it was pretty easy to build. This is before LLMs. I didn't use...
Sidebar, you're also like an engineer, like you can code.
My degree's in computer science and fine arts. So it was more math heavy than actual sort of trade computer science, but a lot of theory. But yes, I can jump into templates, I can do whatever, I can make Craigstarter. And launched Kisa by Kisa with Craigstarter with the discounts if you were a member. And the conversion rate for non-members to members to buy the book. So the book's $100. If you become a member, which costs $100, you get like a $40 coupon. So you could buy the book for $100 or you could buy the book for $160. And 30 or 40%, it was this insane percentage of non-members converted to member to buy the book. And we sold out in basically a day. And I was just like, oh my God, this is weird. I mean, talk about product market fit. I truly did not expect that to happen. And that moment of, you know, Shopify, the system, me setting up this distribution system in Osaka, this interest in what I was doing, the physical object, the fine art object, being able to sell at that price, all coming together, that set in motion everything I've been doing for the last 5 years. And it created this business foundation for my life that I'm really proud of, you know, because it's completely uncompromising. It's so uncompromising.
So many people, I think, kind of, you know, go to college, get the MFA, like get the agent, get, you know, publish their first novel, and it's kind of starts in the classic mainstream publishing world. In a lot of ways, you did everything else first and arrived here. It's just a fascinating trajectory.
Well, I tried to do the other way, and I just got rejected. I got rejected by everybody. Everybody rejected me. 10 years ago, I was trying to sell a book, and I got gaslit by so many agents. Honestly, like, I thought I was losing my mind.
Do you have, I mean, we have a lot of writers at Notion. We have a lot of people, creative people at Notion. I mean, maybe, do you have any advice for them?
I mean, I've been so traumatized by the process. Right, and I think also because of where I came from a very early age, I felt like, okay, I have to own everything. There are no adults in the room. That's kind of what it felt like. I intuited that. And so over the last decade, you know, what I've built up and building up this special projects system and then my own fine art imprint is creating this floor where I don't need Random House to publish me. because I have the system set up. I have these super fans, you know, thousands of members, active members in the system. It is such a great community. It's such a like a community of so much love and support. And so for me, I needed that safety net that I had to build myself and own myself before this could happen. You know, in the Random House thing too, it was really interesting. You know, I pitched and everyone was kind of silent, and I decided I'm gonna do the fine art edition on my own. And then it was 3 months into doing the fine art edition where I committed to it, and we were pretty far along in the process, that Random House said, okay, hey, we really love this book, we want it. And I talked to them, you know, I said, look, I'm already doing my edition, it's really important I maintain fine art rights because I can't give that up. You were saying Sinners, this new movie Sinners, yeah. The director.
Ryan Coogler.
Ryan Coogler kept a lot of his rights.
Yeah, he has, I think, full ownership of his film negatives so that he can basically release it in lots of different forms. So, like, within the studio system, but also out different and more authorial ownership than the studio system would normally allow.
So for me, it was important to keep the fine art. And I said, look, we're not going to compete. My book's going to be $100. Your book's going to be $20 after discounts. Also, like, we'll do a full another rev on it. And the fine art edition came out 18 months ago, and you know this one's coming out now. This is double the length. The shape of it has changed completely. And by putting mine out and feeling like I'd done a version that I was really proud of, it allowed me to relax creatively. And so my editor, Molly at Random House, who was wonderful, totally got the book, totally got what I was trying to do, which is why I agreed to do it, because it wasn't about being blessed by Random House or being seen as official or whatever, even though there is kind of a weird status thing that comes with being published by Random House, I'm feeling more and more. It wasn't about that at all. It was about having a collaborator that really got the book and kind of worked on this level that I didn't work at, you know, more of a mass market level. And she, her response to the other manuscript was to put 300 or 400 questions in the manuscript. And then I spent, this book is basically a response to all her questions. And we built out from that. And then reframed the whole book as a letter to Brian, which felt like this powerful moment.
It's transformative.
In the other book.
I have both books, and they're both wonderful, but very different. And I feel like, yeah, I would love for you to talk about some of those questions that she asked you and what they unlocked for you, because I found it was transformative.
A lot of it was, I have my members who are super fans who know a lot about me, so I don't feel like I have to give context. So I don't give a lot of context in the fine art edition. It's much more minimalist. And this just, imagine you've never heard of me, you've never read any of my writing, you've never read any of my newsletters. You can pick this up and it makes sense. So a lot of it was that. And it turns out that actually writing about that stuff and fleshing out the relationship with Brian, our history, and then reframing it as a letter to Brian allowed me to bring in all these other characters because Brian was foregrounded. So just in terms of craft, the fine art edition, Brian kind of sneaks his way in and then appears at the end. This one, he's there from page one. So he was there, he was protected by being there in the foreground. So I could bring in John, I could bring in Asamura, I could bring in these other characters that aren't in the fine art edition. So it unlocked these other layers of narrative that I think it works really well.
So cool to see. I wanna pause for a second, I know we're getting close, we have about 15 minutes, so I have some quick fire questions for you, but I don't know if we have any questions from our Dory. I'm just gonna check here. Ooh, I think maybe there's a couple. Wait a second. I'm waiting for them to load. While I wait for these to load, I will just maybe ask you a fun question that I thought of, which was, so I saw on your Instagram the other day that you were like, you were at Three Lives and you were excited to be in the window of Three Lives at one of my favorite bookstores also in New York. But which two books would you want to be on either side of this book in Three Lives? I mean, there were books on the sides already, but if you could pick, if you could merchandise the window, which
God,
two books?
God, what a good question. I mean, probably Rings of Saturn or Snow Leopard. And Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard,
nice.
Peter Matheson, Sable.
For folks that don't know those books, do you want to say a word or two about why you like them so much?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Sable, like the way we deal with photography in this book is different than the fine art edition. And it's a lot of the photography is kind of illustrative in line. And Sable, I think, does that really well in Rings of Saturn. His book is a book of walking. And so I kind of drew inspiration from that for this, and the associative qualities of what I'm writing about. And then Annie Dillard, I mean, whenever I have any moment of writing rut or writer's block, I just pick up Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and it just reminds me of what writing can be and should be. There's this kind of joyfulness, this lightness, this beauty, this poetic nature that you can give to almost any event in life. And I think Annie wrote that book in her mid-20s. I mean, it's kind of, you know, she was so good so early. That book reminds me of that. on every page.
Nice.
I just love it.
Nice. Okay. Aria has a question, and you're in the room. Do you want to ask it in person?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
This is really great. I was curious, I mean, I felt like you sort of answered it about why and how you got into the process of walking, but to me it sounds like having a mentor and sort of like being, this tradition being transmitted to you was a big part of that. Is that true? And then if so, do you feel like you have any interest in transmitting that tradition to others? So like, do you feel like your work does that?
It's a good question. Japan, you know, and I think Europe has this as well. Look at Spain, you have the Camino de Santiago, England, all of the rites of ways. You know, I think Europe, more than America, has a big walking tradition, walking history. It's kind of implicit. In Japan also, you know, and most of it's connected to pilgrimage because you couldn't travel 200-300 years ago in Japan. You needed passports to go from one domain to the other. Everything was quite strict. And the one thing that you could say, hey, I want to go do this, and they'd let you go do it, was a pilgrimage. So a lot of these routes are pilgrimage routes. And for me, I loved walking in Tokyo when I first arrived, just because, again, the sense of archetypes and lives being lived, and there's a smallness to everything and a compactness and kind of a density to it, but a peace to it all. And I'd walk all these back streets. I'd be drunk. I really struggled with alcohol throughout my 20s, and I would be on the edge of blacking out doing these big walks in the middle of nowhere of Tokyo, just feeling a kind of love from the sounds of families behind, you know, everything's kind of close. You can hear people in baths, you can hear the radio, you can hear the TV, you can hear people having dinner. And so that was always implicit. I was always kind of drawn to that. And then John, because he was studying Japanese literature and because walking is so intrinsically connected with Japanese literature, like Matsuo Basho, the haiku poet, you know, he did Okuno Hosomichi, The Narrow Road to the North, you know, it was a big walking book. So there's a lot of walking in Japanese literary history. So John, to better understand Japanese literature, started doing his walks when he was 18, 19, 20. And then when he sort of retired in his early 50s, and he started doing it again and started inviting me, we just get along too. We're just like good travel buddies, like super good travel buddies. Like just so easy to, I wish, you know, John's 20 years older than me. Like I wish, I wish we could be married in a way, because it's so easy. Life, like traveling with John, we've traveled together probably for like 6 or 8 months of our life, and it's some of the easiest traveling I've ever done. But we're essentially like brothers, that's what it feels like. And he's kind of like my big brother. And, you know, starting to go on these trips with him and being so easy, and immediately watching him in Japanese, his Japanese is so imperial and beautiful and reverent, and watching him give so much respect to everyone we met along the road, and seeing how that respect, elevating these people we met, changed the people in real time, and changed how they looked at us, and changed how willing they were to support us. That I had never witnessed before. And to watch that, again, day after day after day, for 6 months, 8 months, on the road together, that formed a huge basis for what I'm doing as I'm walking. And it took me a couple years of walking with John before I felt like I had earned the right to go off on my own.
Yeah,
that was a big part of it.
It really like speaks to the, you know, the power of language to build community, to build empathy, to build, you know, build bridges, really. Like it is amazing to watch. He's like a magician in the book when he interfaces with people.
It's unbelievable. And for me, my default stance is let's fight. Like that's my default. I'm gonna kick you in the neck. That's like my default. That's like the voice in the back of my head is always ready to fight. If anyone slights me, if anyone I perceive to be a bully, to be discriminatory or whatever, it's immediately I go to like the worst possible reading of it. And that's just because of where it came from and because you had to protect yourself. And then to watch John, who clearly came from this place of abundance, a family of incredible love and just resources, to not go there and to treat everyone with the sort of from the best possible assumption. And then to elevate everyone and watch these kind of mean people who start off quite mean towards us change and fall in love with us and offer us all these things just in the span of 5, 10, 20 minutes of talking. It's like, wow, okay, this is a way to operate in the world as well. And, you know, just, it's something I wish I could bring back to Brian and me as a kid. You know, it's something I talk about in the book. Like, if we had had one person like this in our childhood, how differently would it have been to not go towards the violence? But
Brittany, who made today? You're good? Okay, all right. Well, you made today possible, so we're gonna thank you anyway. But, yeah, no, I mean, maybe, like, another question for you is about like a walking bucket list. So you you have walked both UNESCO Heritage Routes, which I'm very jealous of because I'm like a nerd about UNESCO heritage sites in general. But like, what about, like, what's your next, like, do you want to do the Alps? Do you want to do, like, where do you want to go?
I mean, I like rewalking. I like this, you know, I read about this.
Yeah, you actually, it's a great part of the book where you talk about you can only know something when you've been there second time.
Yeah, second, third, fourth. I mean, the peninsula I've done, you know, 20, you know, walks of some of these routes. You know, and I even just went back. I'm always like, okay, well, this version of the book, I'm done. I'm never going to write anything about the peninsula. I'm never going to do anything about the peninsula anymore. I got a break. I got to do a break. And then in February, I did a 10-day drive. That was pretty radical to rent a car. But I had to move fast. And I wanted to photograph the people of the peninsula. And I shot this book. It's called Other Thing. And this comes out next week. I shot this kind of in a manic sort of fuss amidst all of the Random House prep. Because I wanted to go back and I wanted to honor all the people I've been meeting and take portraits. And also, I'm really paranoid about getting creatively soggy, you know? And there's something that, you know, I've been working on this book for 4 years and the fine art thing came out 18 months ago. This thing is coming out this week. And it's a long time to sit with one project.
You've wrung it out.
And I'm like, okay, I don't have time to do this book, but I feel like it's almost like an aesthetic practice. And I felt the need to shove it into my schedule to do this 10-day thing where I'm, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. to go get on tuna boats and photograph the sailors and the market people and, you know, the innkeepers and, you know, the pearl divers and all these different people, you know, these sort of monks and stuff. And of all these critical places in the book. But producing this was a way I felt like, how do you keep sharp in the face of the softness that can come from doing something on a bigger stage? And so remembering the roots, being really aesthetic about that.
You don't want to lose your edge.
Yeah. And so, you know, returning to the peninsula yet again and doing this project, I thought, okay, I'm definitely going to be done with this thing now. And then in the middle of doing this, I realized there's another project I want to do on the peninsula. So rewalking, returning, revisiting is really critical. That said, I'd love to walk the Dolomites. I'd love to walk a bunch of Ireland. I just think Irish people are amazing. I think Ireland is great. Plus one. I'd love to go up there. I'd love to do some Scottish walking. I'd love to do the full Camino. I actually haven't done the full French Camino. I've walked the first 150K, the last 120K, and I've walked the Portuguese Camino from the border of Portugal and Spain to Santiago, but I haven't done the full French. And I think if anyone's thinking about doing a big solo walk, I would say the French Camino, it is so much better than I thought it would be. And, you know, it's so well known. Emilio Estevez did a movie, a really bad movie called The Way.
The Way, yeah.
It's terrible. He dies on the first day of the walk. Spoiler alert. He dies immediately. By the way, that first day is very easy. If you die on the first day, you weren't going to make it that far. So he dies and then whatever. It's a very weird movie. But I thought it was going to be like Disneyland. I thought it was going to be overly touristed. I thought it was going to be terrible. And it just turns out it's a 5-week walk, basically. And anyone who commits to something of that scale, it doesn't matter if it's touristic or like, you bond in a very strange way. And it's moving, and the cities and villages are beautiful. So if you're looking, if you're like, oh, I need a sabbatical, or you know, I want to go do something. I want to like kind of reconfigure, rethink about life. Go do the Santiago alone, because you will meet so many people. The way it's set up, you kind of organically meet as many people as you want, or as few people as you want. And I think it's really powerful. And I want to do the full thing at some point. But got to find 5 weeks.
Yeah. You know where to find me.
Yeah.
I wanted to, if you wouldn't mind, close with just like a little paragraph of your book to just read one of
sure.
my favorite parts of it. So let me do that. And then, well, thank you for coming. But this is sort of where it's a couple pages, you know, it's maybe like 30, 40 pages in. Craig has stayed at a bed and breakfast on the road. With a family. It's not the cleanest bed and breakfast. And there is a moment when you're about to leave to kind of go on your day. And a woman appears. She seems like she's a daughter in the family. And I'll go from there. Just then, a woman who looked in her mid-30s opens the front door, strolls in as if she's been waiting for me to finish. Oh, hey, this is our daughter, the wife says. Hello, nice to meet you. Your parents are trying to murder me with bread because you were carbo-loading at the time. She laughs. We chat a bit. but I have to get to walking. The distance loomed large, about 25 kilos with significant elevation to the next inn. As the husband drove me down to the mountains, back to the ECG path, he broke our silence by saying, "She ain't our daughter." I'm entranced by something out the window. Beyond the fields, past a dirt road, in the forest, something burned. Before I register what he said, he comes back with more fluency. "She just appeared years back, wandering the country, needing a job somehow, found us. Not a daughter, but like a daughter. Time passes, life moves, and that's what happens. Things become other things." Thank you, Craig.
Thanks. Can I add one postscript, like a dorky super technical?
It was great. When I hit that, I was like, "This is beautiful."
Oh, well, thank you for picking that. Yeah, that's where the title comes from. But I just have one more thought about, you know, being independent creators and thinking about owning your own space online. I'm pretty pathological about not being dependent on, obviously, a lot of things in life, but also platforms. And so my membership program, I've coded up the entire back end for it. It's in Flask, it's a Python app. And I think this is really important. So thinking about things like, should I launch on Substack? Should I do this? Should I do that? If you have technical acumen and you have the ability to kind of create a space of your own, I found it to be really powerful. And a couple months, basically a month ago, a month and a half ago, Claude Code launched. And I thought, okay, I need a project for this. So I'm like, what if I cloned Twitter just for members? And I have really kind of rigid rules about how I want it to work. Only two posts a day. You can, all the photos are just in one bit, black and white. You can click them to get the color, but otherwise it's quiet. And then everything disappears after a week. So it's all ephemeral. And to have this space that isn't Discord, that isn't Slack. And so I used Claude Code, kind of programmed it together with Vibe Coded or whatever, and created this space that it's called The Good Place. Has anyone seen the TV show The Good Place? So that if you add it to your home screen, the icon is Ted Danson's head. So you get to click Ted Danson's head, it opens up, and it's this kind of Twitter clone. And I thought, okay, this will just be fun to throw up there. And it has turned into my favorite place online. It is such a great community. The energy there, the posts, everyone is so loving. It's so great. And I don't think it could have been built anywhere else. It's because of the bespoke nature of building this thing and having this space and owning this space that people, I think, rise to it in a different way than Discord or something like that. And so anyway, that's just something I've learned over the years that I wouldn't have thought could be that powerful, but it turns out it is.
I love it. The publishing experiments continue.
They continue. And I can't stop.
Go visit The Good Place.
Yeah, The Good Place.
Thank you, Craig Maad, for coming.
Thanks for having
me.
This
was so much fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, Notion.